from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Nationwide, protesters and city officials have taken down statues and monuments of historic figures they deem represent racism and white supremacy. In California, statues of Junipero Serra, Christopher Columbus, and John Sutter have been among the targets for removal. While indigenous groups have called for such actions for decades, they also warn that taking down statues will largely be symbolic if nothing else changes. We talk with indigenous leaders and historians about the trend of removing statues and how we understand and memorialize history. That's next after this news. Welcome to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Throughout California, statues of controversial historical figures such as Junipero Serra and Christopher Columbus are being removed. And this follows a trend across the nation to demolish what some consider symbols of racism, oppression, and injustice. Indigenous leaders have fought for decades against celebrating Serra and Columbus, who they see as having committed genocide against Native Americans. And others argue that destroying statues and monuments could silence some parts of history instead of expanding our knowledge of it. In this hour, we'll dive into the debate over toppling statues and monuments, as well as who we memorialize and why. And let me tell you who is joining us for the hour. I want to welcome Greg Saris, tribal chairman of the Federated Indians of Grayton Rancheria, also endowed chair of creative writing and American Indian literature at Sonoma State University. And welcome back, Greg. Good to have you.
Good morning, Michael.
We also want to welcome for this hour Valentin Lopez, who is chairman of the Amamustan Tribal Band, and welcome to the program. Good to have you aboard.
Thank you very much, Michael.
Thank you. We also say good morning to Damian Bassage, who joins us as well, professor at San Jose State University, founder of the California Frontier Project, and welcome, Professor Bassage.
Hi, Michael. Thanks for having me on.
Glad to have you on. And Greg Saris, I'm going to begin with you. Well, we go back decades, and certainly this has been a cause celebre for you for decades, a battle against these monuments that represent an embodiment, as you see it, of genocide and of colonization and of all the dreadful things that were done to indigenous people. But let me go right to the heart of things. It's been frustrating to get these statues removed, these monuments removed. What about the fact that they're being vandalized and toppled down by protesters? How does that square with you?
Well, you know, Michael, that's the problem. These are quick actions. I, of course, wanted them, as you mentioned, to have them taken down. But the real question is not just destroying these, but how do we keep the dialogue about and a larger story? How do we continue to keep a dialogue and a larger story going about a more actual history of what these men represented? John Sutter, another person here in California, who has been a California hero, enslaved California Indians, and worked with federally financed vigilante groups to kill us during the gold rush. So the real question is, you know, you can tear them down, Michael, and I would like to see them come down, but the big thing is what happens in the void? How do we continue? How does this spark a dialogue about history that will continue? And that's what concerns me.
Well, what about the ideas that have been put forward, such as why not have a museum with historical explanations or someplace outdoors, or maybe even there have been suggestions that some of this money that's available, and not that much money is available these days, could be put into a park to honor indigenous people, or a dance area, give back shell mounds, those kinds of things. In fact, I think April McGill, a Native activist, has been talking about these kinds of things for quite a while as well. Would they be in your picture of where to move?
That's one place. But the bigger place is in the schools, Michael, in the curriculum. And that's why my tribe has financed a $6.8 million project with the Smithsonian to create a template that will be first here in the California schools for 4th, 8th, and 12th grades to teach a more broad and inclusive history that will include the lessons we can learn from this history, Michael, about cultural arrogance, entitlement. What do these stories tell us? What do these men represent that predicates colonialism, These are the things that I really am concerned about. You can do all the museums and all the little areas you want, but what happens is they become tourist places and names and all of that. But how do the lessons of this history stay with us in our lived lives and how we work out problems today in this world?
Well, let me go to Valentin Lopez, who again chairs the Amamatsun tribal band. And there is a good deal of more consideration, isn't there, Valentin, for example, Junipero Serra's role in terms of not only the slave trade, but all of the dreadful things that he has been identified with, whippings and so forth of Native Americans, and really is essentially not even recognize them as human beings or having souls. Taught more in the schools now than we'd ever imagine, aren't they? Those kinds of things?
That, you mean the more true history is being taught now, or,
yeah,
or
exactly.
That older history?
More authentic history, or certainly more the mixed history of what, I mean, for example, Junipero Serra was declared a saint by Pope Francis, and that was a major controversy I know you remember quite well.
Yes.
And that clouds people's minds. And I know you've been fighting the papal bull on this because it still exists, and there are other papal bulls. But what I'm asking you directly is there have been strives, haven't there? There have been progress in terms of educating as far as the reality of, if you will, the sins of people like Father Junipero Serra.
Well, you know, Michael, we've been talking about it, but really we feel that people are not listening. The school curriculum, they can still teach, what they've done is the teachers can't change the curriculum or teach other curriculum now, but not all of them do. A lot of them teach that curriculum that's been around forever. The sugar cube missions and the popsicle stick missions are still being built in some schools. And, you know, and what has to be, there has to be a uniform application to that.
Well, let me go right at the heart of this with you, Valentin. What is it? I've been mentioning some things, but I'd like to know from your perspective, what is it that indigenous people find so objectionable about Junipero Serra, or for that matter, Christopher Columbus, who is still a cultural hero to many Italian Americans?
Well, the true history of Native people have never been told. We've been ignored, forgotten, and erased from history. You're right that Junipero Serra was canonized by Pope Francis in 2015, but about 3-4 months prior to him being canonized in Ecuador, Pope Francis gave an apology to the indigenous people for the sins, the crimes, and the offenses of the Catholic Church. And that was a phony apology, to be honest with you, because, like I said, 3-4 months later, they canonized Junipero Serra, who was responsible for those very sins, crimes, and offenses right here in California, And whenever the last, when the missions were closing, the last Padre Precedente, Mariano Paredes, he wrote to the superiors in Mexico City, and he told them that we have to find a way to explain what has happened here. All we have done is baptize the Indians, give it some sacraments, and bury them. There are no Indians left along the coast, and we are going to be judged harshly and with scorn. And that's when they came up with the excuse that the priests treated the Indians as children, that the priest, that the church, that the Indians came voluntarily. They came to learn agriculture. They came for a better life, and they came to find God. Nothing could be further than the truth for that, but that was the alibi or the excuse that the church wanted to offer in place of the truth of what actually happened. And that's where the curriculum from California came from for all that time. Now the truth is seeping in, but the true history of the missions is still not being recognized or told.
So you're talking about true history as opposed to a fake history, and this has certainly been the case with respect to the Confederacy, and we'll talk about this later with another professor of history, but I wanted to go to Damian Bassich, who is professor of history at San Jose State and founder of the California Frontier Project. And history gets pretty mixed, Professor Bassich. In fact, There was an article in the San Francisco Chronicle which pointed out that when we're talking about somebody like Ulysses S. Grant, for example, when you know that was one of the statues that was hit in Golden Gate Park, we're talking about someone who was a slave owner, and that's disgraceful by any standards, even the standards of the day, but he was also someone who was a complex figure. He led the Union Army in its victory in the Civil War. He was a forceful advocate against the Ku Klux Klan and for Reconstruction. In other words, how can complex histories be told when you just got a monument there or a statue there?
Well, Michael, I think you hit on a real important point. And speaking of complexity, I just want to be clear. I'm a professor of world languages and literatures, and I did my background work and my PhD on writers, especially an indigenous writer, Inca Garcilaso de la Vega, so from South America. So I'm coming at this definitely as somebody who loves history, but I don't want to, my friends in the history department at San Jose State University, I just want to make sure for that,
I don't want to create any internecine warfare there, so forgive me for making you a professor
exactly.
of history. Okay.
So, yeah, it's complex, in fact. And I think, you know, one of the things you mentioned, for example, is exactly that we're teaching the history of the missions in fourth grade. And I think that that's one of the things that's very difficult to do is to teach complexity in fourth grade. And, you know, when we talk about Sarah, when we talk about the missions, I mean, these are things that have a lot of layers. And, for example, I mean, one of the things that you mentioned was that Sarah, you know, didn't believe that Native people had souls. But actually, that was the whole point of his whole life, was to try and save the souls of Native people, as he saw it at the time, etc. So I think that the other thing that we have to keep in mind is that the missions themselves evolved, you know, over many years. If you look, the Spanish were practicing the whole mission system for 200 years before they got to California. And when you think about it, it was always something conceived to serve the Spanish crown, but it changed its face many times. In the 17th century, for example, you had militias where Guarani people in Paraguay wiped out 4,000 Portuguese slave traders, and they were carrying guns. And so, I mean, I think that the idea of what the mission system was evolved and became very, very different by the time we got to 18th century California. But it's really hard to talk about these things when you have to, you know, third and fourth graders, you can only really sort of paint things in very broad strokes.
But apart from education, you can see why people would be indignant and even vehemently enraged at the idea that some of these figures are lionized when they were figures who can be easily identified with oppression and colonization and enslavement. It's very difficult, in other words, for many people to make a separation between those two. Is there a way to preserve, well, the history, the complexity of the history, and make it apparent to people?
You know, for me, and you know, some historians may disagree, but I think history is all about the people and individual people, you know, and digging into the lives of individual people and what they say about themselves and what other people said about them. So, you know, for example, I agree with Valentin and with Greg that there are many Native figures in California that we don't learn about, that we don't hear about. You know, if you think of a man like Sem Yeto, who was a leader of the Patwin people and was known also, he was baptized as Francisco Solano. You know, Solano County is named after him, but who knows that he was a big, important, strong war leader of the Patwin people and an ally of General Vallejo, or that Stanislaus County is named after Stanislaus, a native person from Mission San Jose who led a rebellion in the 1820s. So, I mean, these are things that people need to know about, and I don't think that it also involves knowing about these people and knowing the complexity of their story is something that necessarily involves, you know, getting rid of Sarah or any other people related to the colonial project.
I like what you're emphasizing here. We need to know more and honor more of women and people of color in our history. That's a given. But let me go back to Greg Saris. Greg, we invited the Diocese of Sacramento and the California Catholic Conference. We got a statement from Sacramento Bishop Jaime Soto on the removal of the Saris statue in Sacramento's Capitol Park. And I'd like you to respond, if you would, to his statement. He said, "The act of vandalism does little to build the future. There is no question that California's indigenous people endured great suffering during the colonial period and then later faced the horror of government-sanctioned genocide under the nascent state of California. This legacy is heartbreaking. Yet it is also true that while Father Sarah worked under this colonial system, he denounced its evils and worked to protect the dignity of Native peoples. His holiness as a missionary should not be measured by his own failures to stop the exploitation or even his own personal faults." So there's again that complex view of someone like Sarah, and your response.
Michael, that's true. But there are documents documented in the missions here. I don't know about him specifically. But remember, it's documented, and in fact, some of his soldiers, the padres in the San Jose mission, Mission Dolores in San Francisco, and Mission San Rafael, were so violent to the Indians, the screaming and the tortures. Remember, the soldiers, Spanish soldiers, of course, accompanied the missions, the padres. They wrote to Mexico saying how awful it was, and as a consequence, Junipero Serra had the soldiers then moved away from the actual mission and camped elsewhere. So there's documents that what the Catholic Church is just saying there are not actually true at all. That Junipero Serra and the padres were men who were violent, who tortured the Indians, and they believed, remember, they had a thing about suffering as a way to heaven. And they subjugated us via these horrible measures in the missions, and it's well documented. So, you know, the Catholic Church can say that, you know, Junipero Serra was well-intentioned or whatever they can say, and maybe in his mind he was, but in our minds, violence and genocide and the kinds of things that happen and are documented in the mission by the Franciscan padres are hardly worthy.
And again, Greg Saris is tribal chairman of the Federated Indians of Great Rancheria. And Valentin Lopez, let me go back to you. Valentin Lopez is chair of the Amam Mutsun Tribal Band. What about the argument, Valentin, that you tear down a statue, but it's just a symbol? Native people are suffering and they need help now. The high numbers of COVID-19 sufferers, especially among the Navajo, they don't even have running water available down there. That should be a priority somehow? What do you say to that argument?
Well, you know, we talk about history, but we also have to talk about the impact of history. And that's a conversation that doesn't happen too much at all. You know, the impact of that brutal history is what led us to the conditions that we have today that make us very vulnerable to the COVID virus and to the other diseases that we suffer from, including addictions and suicide and depression, incarceration. You know, there is all an impact of that brutal mission period. And people don't talk about it. You know, that we've been calling for the removal of the missions because the way to heal is to tell the true history. And the true history today ignores, forgets, and erases us from history. And we're saying it's time to not honor those people who are responsible for the destruction and domination of indigenous people, but it's time to tell the truth and to recognize the people that were here before and never let them be forgotten. You know, our people were not hunters and gatherers. They were very effective land managers, the stewards of the land, et cetera. And we're doing a lot now to bring back to restore that knowledge and to bring it back and to start practicing it. But, you know, that's the history that people have got to learn about as well. You know, tearing down that mission, I mean, we just got tired of calling for it. I know that it's a crime to tear down missions, and we don't support criminal activity and stuff like that. But people get, you know, people are just tired of waiting and they're just frustrated.
Well, if I go back to Damian Bassich on this. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you. I just want to sort of clarify something with Damian Bassich on this. Let's just talk about the missions for a moment, Professor Bassich, because I hear what Valentin is saying, and it's certainly been said, and maybe not even said enough, but the reality is I'm thinking about something Corinne Fairbanks said, part of the Native American activist movement. She said the missions were concentration camps. They were places of death, and spiritual and cultural history was erased, essentially, by this attempt to what you described as saving souls.
Yeah, you know, once again, the way to, I think that we have to try and understand the missions from the voices of the people who were there. One of the people who you can read, actually one of the few native voices in talking about the missions, a man named Pablo Tak, who grew up at the San Luis Rey mission in the 1820s. And he wrote, well, first of all, he wrote a grammar of Luiseno language. And he also wrote a story of his people, the Luisenos, or the Quechnawichum. And, you know, what he describes is not a concentration camp. It's a tough place, perhaps because it's a working farm. And he describes people who were the native people on the mission, who were not passive, but who were strong, who let the Spanish know that they were there because they let them there. In fact, when he tells the story of how the missionaries came to his area, he said, "It's a wonder that our people did not kill them," because evidently the leader of the people at that point struck up a friendship with Antonio Peri, who was the man, the friar who founded Mission San Luis Rey. So I think when you think about it in those terms, this was a very complex negotiation between the native people and between the Spanish. But also when we think about Spanish, they weren't really Spanish people from Spain other than the missionaries. The soldiers and settlers who came north from what is today Mexico, Sonora, Sinaloa, were people of mixed ethnicity, both indigenous, mestizo, and African, Afro-Latino, and European as well. So the picture is, I don't think it does much of a service to really take these symbols of horror and just apply them to something as complex as the missions. And I would say each mission was different itself.
Each mission had its own distinctiveness. I think that's absolutely right. But let me invite our listeners to participate in this discussion. And what do you think of removing statues and monuments dedicated to historic figures, and what should take their place? You can give us a call right now, and I invite you to do that. Toll-free number, 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. Or get in touch on Twitter and Facebook. We're at KQED Forum. Or email forum@kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny, and we're talking about the removal of statues and monuments dedicated to historic figures and the ongoing controversy of what should take their place, but not only how they should be brought down if they indeed memorialize or lionize, if you will, figures who have been identified with slavery and oppression and terrible deeds. I'm getting a lot of comments here. Let me read some of them. Susan writes, "I'm a 73-year-old California native, and when we were in grammar school, Junipero Serra and the California missions were part of the completely positive history of California. We were not taught about the Mexican-American War, the Gold Rush, and Bear Republic. We're taught as acts of heroism and initiative. I think historical education and not state or national propaganda should be taught at all levels of education." I think that's what Valentin Lopez was talking about as true history. Here's Robert, who says, "Taking down monuments to Jefferson Davis or Junipero Serra is not rewriting history, but a starting point to say we don't want to honor them. That said, I don't support removal without a community-based democratic process. That process will lead to a wider discussion and understanding of historical events." And Thomas writes, "In my opinion, statues conceal history and reduce the complex stories to false idols. Taking down statues is revealing history, particularly hidden truths, and yes, removing statues is only symbolic, not actual progress that impacts real lives. Gregory writes, I had Gregory here for a moment. Let me read some more of these comments. Gary writes, Germans took down statues of Hitler. Russians took down statues of Stalin. History has not forgotten, but madman murderers are not being honored and celebrated. And Spencer says, as we move into the internet age, the physical world has never mattered less, as the retail apocalypse illustrates. No one notices statues anymore. We barely acknowledge each other over the dinner table as we browse our phones. The relevant question to me is, how can marginalized people be more visible and play more of a public role in the online world we live in? So we're getting some good comments here, and we'll read some more of them, and we'll try to take your calls. But I want to go first to Adam Dombey, who's history professor, really is a history professor at College of Charleston, and author of The False Cause, Fraud, Fabrication, and White Supremacy. Adam, give me the whole title here. It says In Confederate. Am I missing a word here?
In Confederate Memory. The last word is memory. Okay. False Cause, Fraud, Fabrication, and White Supremacy in Confederate Memory.
Well, there's a lot of that, to be sure. And a lot of that has come through, as you pointed out, in articles of yours that I've read from the Daughters of the Confederacy, and certainly from an attempt to preserve what is seen as, the lost cause narrative. Let's talk about that for a moment. Slavery is not included in that narrative, and that's been a Southern narrative for many years.
Well, yeah, in some ways slavery isn't included, but in other ways it can be. It's sometimes included as a positive good, where individuals will try to portray slavery in a positive light, which, let's be clear, slavery was a terrible institution premised on terror and torture.
Yeah, but forgive me, that's what I meant to say. The tragedy of slavery was never represented in that.
It ignores the sort of reality of slavery and instead glosses over it. It's a narrative of history that white Southerners had pushed after the Civil War and continue to push, that really obscures a lot of the realities of the Civil War, including the causes of the Civil War, which were very clearly slavery. But by changing those causes, it helps sort of argue and portray Confederates as heroic.
Well, they also made the Civil War into a battle over states' rights, not over slavery, right?
Exactly. And that's really, on the one hand, it serves today to obscure the racist connections and the racist roots of the Confederacy. But at the time that they first started rewriting it, it had less to do with rewriting about white supremacy as being a negative as it was about turning a defeated force into the victors. Because if you fought a war for states' rights, and states' rights still exist and in fact are quite important in the early 20th century for defending Jim Crow, then you don't have you haven't lost. You've won.
So let me cut to the chase here. Instead of canceling history, or for that matter, toppling monuments or statues, what's the best way to approach this kind of history, to not only approach it, but to preserve it and understand it at the same time?
Well, I think the first thing we have to recognize is that monuments don't teach history. They fundamentally don't. If you're really worried, and a lot of the people who are most worried, at least in the public sphere, it seems, about the existence of monuments, politicians and the like, are the same politicians who want to cut the National Endowment for the Humanities and cut education funding and cut funding to the humanities and focus just on STEM. If you're really worried about preserving history, history isn't taught by monuments. Monuments teach values and who's worthy of celebration. History is a critical analysis of the past, and that's taught in classes, through books, through documentaries. That's where you learn history. So I don't think that monuments are where we learn history. In fact, frequently monuments give a skewed version of history.
Is there a danger of a kind of cancel culture, though, in taking down monuments or vandalizing them? And in Boston, for example, Christopher Columbus, the head of the statue of him was decapitated, cut off.
I mean, there is the Columbus statues that have been put up around the United States weren't put up to actually celebrate the historical figure Columbus. They were largely erected to help Italian Americans feel included. They were meant to sort of be an inclusive nature and to allow Italian Americans to feel part of America. And so he never arrived in the United States. He never got here. Why are we celebrating him? And he, committed horrible travesties and was participatory in what ultimately became genocide, as well as slavery and the rape of indigenous people. So if we want to actually study the history of Columbus, then these monuments are obscuring it because they're telling you he's so worthy of celebration. Now, if you want to look at the history of monuments and the way these monuments function, then in some ways, perhaps a monument being removed makes it less obvious that it was there. But when I do my research as a historian of monuments and someone who actually looks at these monuments, I rarely look, I'll visit the monument sometimes, but all I really need to know is what it looked like, and a photograph will do just fine. So I'm not sure that we're necessarily going to lose history so much as have conversations that allow us to have a better understanding of what history often also entails, because these monuments were meant to portray a specific memory of the past that celebrated things. And sometimes these things aren't worth celebrating.
And Adam Dotme is history professor at the College of Charleston, author of The False Cause, Fraud, Fabrication, and White Supremacy in Confederate Memory. And let's get a caller on here. Denise, join us. You're on. Morning.
Good morning. So my thought is that this conversation was precipitated by the toppling of monuments. And prior to this, I didn't hear a lot of conversation about, you know, the real history versus this kind of whitewashed history. So I'm all for toppling a monument to start a conversation, because honestly, people have been trying to have these discussions and use the democratic process and petitions, and bureaucracy would not allow these monuments to be discussed, to be removed, but toppling them started a conversation.
So it's a catalyst as you see it, and that's not a bad thing. I appreciate your thoughts, and I thank you for the call. Let me get another caller on here. Roger joins us next. Roger, welcome.
Thank you. Throughout the state of California, along all of our freeways and highways, there are markers for historical landmarks. When you stop at these and read those historical landmarks, which I've done, they start at colonialism and go on from there. The Native American history and culture is completely ignored or just given a coverage about how it was made better. I would suggest one way to start correcting things would be to go to each of those historical landmarks and afford the opportunity to our Native American scholars to come in and put in the rest of the story, and add a description of what actually took place in that location as colonization took place and what existed there prior to colonization. And I think that that would be of help. It's a little thing, but still, when you start seeing what the story in this country was, especially in California, it's very eye-opening. And that's just, to me, a glaring glitch, a missing piece that should be in place.
What do you think of that suggestion? Valentin Lopez, I'll go to you. You like it?
I think right now with Governor Newsom in place, there would be a possibility of actually creating legislation or executive order that would allow that process to occur if it was pursued.
Well, I didn't hear Valentin's voice, so I'll go to Greg now. Greg Saras?
I'm here now. When are you ready?
Okay. Did you hear the comment from the listener? And I wondered if you thought it was a good idea. Yeah.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. You know, that's what we've asked for. We've asked for those markers, those mission-bound markers along the El Camino Real to be removed, and to tell the true history, and to tell the, you know, a bit of history from the local tribe there, so that that tribe will not be forgotten ever. That's one of the goals of our mission, you know. So I agree. And then the other thing is, you know, those markers and monuments and statues, you know, they're saying, what does a society value and what does a society honor? And are these people really worthy of that value and that honor that is given to them? You know, I mean, like, you look at Sarah, I mean, over 100,000 Indians died during the mission period.
I think you've just raised again the central question. And I'd like to hear actually what Professor... let me go back to Professor Dombey on this, because it's a really central question about where the line should or ought to be drawn. We know, for example, that the father of our country, George Washington, was a slave owner, and so was Thomas Jefferson, who wrote the Declaration of Independence. It's complicated history in terms of who we honor, just as Valentin was saying, and what that honor really tells us in terms of lionizing someone who has done dreadful and unconscionable kinds of things. You want to opine on this, Adam Bomdy?
Yeah, I mean, I think first off, I want to point out Valentine is exactly right when we talk about this issue of these monuments aren't teaching history. They're about who to valorize and who we see as worthy of celebration. And here in the American South, where I'm based out of, it's almost impossible to remove a monument legally. They passed what are called heritage protection acts, such that literally, every time a Confederate monument's being pulled down, it's in large part because there is no legal means to remove them and bring about these discussions of history, which I think one of your callers made a really interesting point, is that, you know, these discussions around monuments are teaching more history than the monuments have done their entire existence. I mean, I've been called by more reporters in the last month than in my entire life previous to this. Suddenly people are interested in Civil War history again. And so I think one thing we really need to remember about monuments is that they are celebratory in nature. And so if we have to have a discussion about whether someone's worthy of celebration, that's not a bad discussion to have. That's a good discussion that's going to allow everyone to learn a little bit more history. And I would just add, and I think this is an important one, George Washington, when you bring up the issue of slavery, and I want to be clear, the issue of his relations with Native Americans and other founding fathers' relations with Native Americans is a separate issue that I think is worthy of discussion as well. But when we're talking about slavery, at least, Jefferson Davis and Robert E. Lee have monuments because they fought to preserve slavery. Thomas Jefferson has a monument despite owning people. And so perhaps that monument needs updating to teach a fuller history about his thing. And perhaps it is a discussion worthy of having of whether or not we even want to honor these individuals. But having that discussion is fundamentally, I think, in a democratic process is a good thing. And it allows us to sort of hash out what we as a society want to celebrate. And so if you take away the ability to remove monuments, what you're doing is forcing the hand of those who want to have this discussion and forcing them to take more drastic action, like pulling monuments down.
I'm going to bring some more listeners into this. Let me get Robert on, who's joining us from Ventura. Robert, you're on the air. Good morning.
Hello there. Good morning. I'm just commenting on some of the inappropriate and anachronistic language being used to describe the missions and what was happening in them, such as genocide and concentration camps. The word genocide itself is a UN term from the 20th century and talks about deliberate extermination of peoples. That is certainly the opposite of what the Franciscan missionaries were attempting to do in late 18th and early 19th century California.
I thank you for that. There is distinctions that have to be made between literal genocide and cultural genocide. It's a word that's often bandied about with too much ease and needs to be used much more wisely. I'd agree with the sentiment that I think was behind that call. But we also have trouble with other elements of language, and perhaps we ought to focus on that a little bit with you, Greg Saris. When we talk, for example, about oppression and dehumanization, there are words that need to be, I think, codified, and they need to be specifically pointed out in terms of details and in terms of specifics. And that can be done, as you said earlier, through education. It needs to be done through education.
Yes, and again, I like what you said earlier, Michael, this, all of this, the statues being a catalyst. But I want to respond somewhat to the last caller, if I may. With an example from my own tribe, the Federated Indians of Great Rancheria, which will illuminate a little bit of the consequences of this history, Michael. At the time, it were comprised of survivors from Southern Pomo and Coast Miwok tribes from Sonoma County and all of Marin County. At the time of contact, there were approximately 20,000 of us. Today, of the 1,450 enrolled members, we all trace our ancestry back to one of 14 survivors, all of whom were women, all of whom were wives or concubines of the Mexicans or early Americans. Call it what you will, also called the Great Survivor. But the problem here is with American Indians, we have tended to be the prick in the American conscience. Americans can say, well, slavery was bad. We got rid of it. Never mind the legacy of slavery. And immigrants chose to come here. But there is a true reluctance to deal with the fact that American people are on stolen land, stolen a bloody theft. And so it's going to be, it's an upward, you know, battle. As Valentin said earlier, people, we've been saying these things, the local folks know these things, it's been passed down in our families, the stories, whether they're written or not. But the truth, these stories remain, and you can call it what you will by whatever term, but the murder of thousands of people and the consequences of colonialism, 80% of our kids dropping out by ninth grade until 10 or 15 years ago, life expectancy for a California Indian man, 47 years until very recently. Those are things that we live with. Those are living. And until we all can talk about these things in some way, be it via the tearing down of the monuments or the curriculum in the schools, this kind of thing is going to be, particularly for Indian people, going to be pushed aside, these stories.
And again, Greg Saris is tribal chair of the Federated Indians of Great Rancheria. And Wanda is our next caller. Wanda, good morning. Welcome.
Hi. Thank you for having me. And hello to Greg and Valentin. I'm Wanda Quittiquit, Greg. And I am all for that taking down of that Sarah statue. That has caused us so much grief. You know, when you pass these statues, yes, we don't go and, you know, take pictures of it and stand by and all that jazz. But you just have to, when you have to pass by these things, it just, it does raise a trauma in terms of why don't we have statues? What happened there? And yes, I would say that that's our fault as tribes not erecting a statue to honor our people. So we in Lake County have decided, seven tribes here, and we have come together with the county to erect a statue in our downtown town of Lakeport, right in front of our key museum there. And so it was unanimous among the board of supervisors to do that because they recognized the history of the Bloody Island massacre here, and that is the telling thing of for them to understand what happened to the Pomo people here in Lake County. And so we are raising money very slowly to erect this statue. It will be a Pomo family statue, pre-contact. And this is something, and, you know, the building of all of the Sarah, I just take that one as an example. Nobody asked us. Nobody asked us for our opinion. We didn't give input into that. You know what it would have been. So this whole thing of that this should be a community effort, well, these statues mostly are erected through private funds. And to have legislation come in so that these wealthy people can put up the statues commemorating these murderers and leaders that have to give us a grief, you know, is, you know, so we decided that we needed this for our youth, for the future, as a means of education. And going back to education, the state of California did approve Native curriculum, but I don't know where it is. Nobody knows where it is and how it's being done. But again, you know, this whole thing of the statues is, it goes more than just what some of your talkers have been talking about.
It's complicated, and it's profoundly difficult. And Wanda, I thank you for that call. I want to go to some more listener comments here and hear what listeners are thinking. Carol writes, each state gives two statues for display in the Capitol building in Washington, D.C. California's are Father Junipero Serra and President Ronald Reagan. They can be changed. I'd like to suggest substituting John Muir for Junipero Serra. And John Muir is, of course, responsible, this listener writes, for the preservation of Yosemite Valley, a priceless treasure and a founder of the modern environmental movement. Caroline writes, I feel like there are definitely ways to continue celebrating Italian-American heritage in San Francisco while eliminating the focus on Columbus. And I feel like the Italian-American community might be great allies to make this happen. But I think having more experience and direct communication with the Native American community would help. April says statues, monuments, buildings, and the like named after racist historical figures shouldn't be removed. There should be signage added to the site stating what the person did that was racist. And a tweet from Noel. Noel writes, it seems to me that the toppling of statues gives the participants an immediate feeling of vindication, but it does not help the more messy long-term work of coming to terms with our history and how to address it without either whitewashing or erasing. And as I said, lots of people weighing in here. Let me read some more comments. James writes, studying history is an academic discipline. I was taught that objectivity requires suspension of judgment. I learned that taking offense at historic realities is both pointless and absurd, since we have no real understanding of what happened or the people involved, and our modern-day perspectives are not those of the characters we study. What can you say about the prevailing attitude towards judgment and taking offense at history? And I'm going to go to you on that, Professor Bassich. I'd like to hear your response.
Yeah, I think that, you know, I think that objectivity is very important. I think one can be objective and also judge the events of history. I think, for example, that if we look at a person like Sarah and contrast him with a person like John Muir, you know, John Muir, for example, for all he did for Yosemite, he very much felt that Native American presence on the land was a blight and not a management as we've understood it to be. Whereas a person like Sarah, who he probably, we wouldn't necessarily share a lot of his ideas today, but he actually felt that Native people were to be valued and he would give his life for them. So I think that the important thing is to dig deeply into people's lives, into their motivations, and into the context that they found themselves in. Because without the context, man, it's really hard to make a good assessment of what happened in the past. So yeah, I think that when we look at statues, the first thing that comes to our mind oftentimes is the toppling of toppling Saddam's statue in Baghdad in 2003, or, you know, Stalin, Lenin in Red Square in Moscow. And so these are things that elicit, you know, visceral responses in people. And yeah, history, we need to understand it, and it also needs to move us. But I don't think that stops us from being objective about it.
So I'm hard to be objective about history, though, because there are many people who have strong visceral responses to it, but that's maybe a topic for another day. I want to get another caller in here. Morningstar Gully joins us from Sacramento, and welcome to the program. Good morning.
Thank you for having me on.
You're certainly welcome. Tell us what's on your mind.
I just want to say that I am appreciative that Chairman Lopez's voice is included in this conversation. I think that we need to be hearing more from tribal leadership and not necessarily historians, as the tribal leadership and community members are the experts on this issue, that we're the ones that have been impacted directly. I have just been a part of an effort here in Sacramento where we were able to bring down three statues within 2 weeks, the Sarah statue, the Columbus statue, and the Sutter statue. And there's definitely more work to be done in terms of renaming places and acknowledging the traditional history of indigenous peoples.
Thank you for that. Good to hear from you. I appreciate the call. That's Morningstar Gully. And Greg Sarris, we've got a little time left here. I want to go back to you because you've been involved in the casinos, and I think there's a point to be made in that a lot of people don't see the history and they don't see the suffering that you alluded to earlier, the fetal alcoholism and the economic deprivation and the difficulties. They see, for example, casinos, which are certainly not thriving in the pandemic, but have been thriving, and that's all they see.
Yeah, well, I jokingly say, Michael, that people in California didn't know there were Indian people here until there were casinos. But that said, the casinos, for those of us who have them, and if we're doing the right things with them and right by our people, have really lifted people up. It's changed things. As I said, 10 years ago in my own tribe, approximately 80% of us are dropping out from high school. Today we have students in Stanford, Berkeley, and UCLA. Things are changing. And with the power that we have, I think, in Sacramento, we can also work with our legislators. And I would make an argument that some of the response from a lot of the legislators is as a result of the money and pressuring that, you know, Indian people are able to do today. It's too bad it has to just go that way, but If I say, you know, gosh, if we can't get social justice and a more accurate history, damn it, we'll buy it.
Well, let me, on that note, say we can all hope for not only social justice, but accurate history. And I want to thank all the participants in this hour. Greg Sarris, again, is tribal chairman of the Federated Indians of Grayton Rancheria and endowed chair of creative writing at American Indian Literature, Sonoma State University. Thank you, Greg.
Thank you, Michael, for having me.
And thank you, Valentin Lopez. Valentin Lopez chairs the Amamatsun Tribal Band. Good to have you with us this morning. Appreciate it.
I'd like to say one last thing very fast, Michael, is that not only the natives need to heal, perpetrators need to heal. That's the state of California. That's the Catholic Church. That's many other perpetrators.
That's a good note.
They must heal from their historic trauma as well.
I appreciate that note, and I want to also express appreciation to Damian Bassett, who joined us this hour, professor at San Francisco State and founder of the California Frontier Project, and Adam Dombey, history professor at the College of Charleston and author of The False Cause. And I'm at the end of this hour to say that some big changes are being made here at KQED as well. Mina Kim is going to be your host in the second hour. I'm going to be host continuing in the first hour, but cutting back my time a little. I'll be in with you Monday through Friday in the 9 o'clock hour, Mina on in the 10 o'clock hour. Stay tuned for more on this radio station and for all of us here at KQED Public Radio. Thank you for being a part of the program. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.